So this is, I think everyone knows the format, but this is the first of three sort of brief presentations, and then us three presenters will gather on stage for a discussion of some of the themes that we're raising. So my name is Jace Clayton, and just briefly, I'm going to talk about all the good things: copyright, travel, and God. And you know, it's funny. I was reflecting on this conference, and I realized, you know, as a DJ, I always sort of ignored copyright, right? And the reason for that was because copyright ignored me, which is to say, this idea of the DJ mix, it's at the very core of it, you're taking all these different works by other people and you're blending them together, you're layering them on top of each other, you're mixing them up, you're changing the speed, you're creating your own narrative out of other people's work. And that work of the DJ, it's obsessed me. I love it. I still love it to that day. And copyright sort of prevents, it's a legal framework that prevents people from seeing or valuing that. And so I ignored copyright, and copyright ignored me in the first many years of my career as a DJ. And at one point, the man who represents Nina Simone's copyright got in touch. I'd used a little bit of gold, of plain gold ring in a mix. And so he wrote myself and the label that put out this sort of bootleg, quote unquote bootleg mix. And the label owner just wrote back this high-powered lawyer explaining the number of copies we'd sold, explaining that it was in the context of this very dense mix that had, you know, 50 different music tracks on it, often playing several playing at the same time. And the lawyer didn't even bother to write back to us. You know, it wasn't worth his interest to go after it. Which points to the way in which many of these DJ cultures, in terms of who can copy, what can be copied, what can be permitted, they're often quite self-policing in that, and even interfacing with a legal framework like we did. But this was the first stage of my existence as a DJ. You know, I was putting up mixes as cassette mixtapes, and then CDs and MP3s, and at each stage of that, I always felt like I was reaching the people I needed to reach. But then in the past maybe 4 or 5 years, I've actually been seeing how my music, the bulk of my recorded music as a DJ, it's actually traveling less and less. And the reason for that is because we're entering this strange moment where sort of the musical archives, where people go to listen to music, it's moving away from having a file on your own computer or having a physical object in your collection, and it's moving towards something being available only as a digital stream. And so services like Spotify or YouTube, they have these sort of copyright sniffing algorithms built into it. So if you try and upload a mix of mine to YouTube, you'll see the image, but the sound will be muted because there's all these copyright violations built into it. So whereas before, I was like, yeah, people want to hear DJ Rupture music, they can do that. And now it's just becoming much and much more difficult. And the strange thing about the sort of the automatic algorithmic takedown is there's no longer that kind of discussion. You know, the email that we sent to Nina Simone's lawyers, that was a bit of a conversation. And that is, those days are over. And of course, it's troubling to me because I'm watching as my art slowly exits the historical record. But it's even more troubling when I think about how this overall historical record, the container for all this music we listen to and love, it's increasingly a very commercial, a very corporate container. And we're seeing this situation where copyright pretty much exists to sort of regulate the passage into those very specific sites with very specific rules. And so there's even been instances where, for example, I've posted a music of my own, a remix that I've done for a band on SoundCloud, and had it been rejected automatically by their algorithms. So I'm thinking we're in this moment where it feels like these sort of algorithms that let one listen or not listen, they feel very, it feels like we can't address them. You know, who can talk to Google? Who can complain about Facebook's algorithm? So there's something quite godlike about this situation. There's something quite theocratic. You know, we're making the appeals. Can you please create a library instead of this sort of strange corporate container? And it rarely works. And so thinking about that, you know, sort of YouTube algorithms as this new God force in our life that's regulating access to culture, that's sort of shaping our desires, that's unseen and yet so present. I started thinking about another form of God as it relates to music and copying, and that's Quranic recitation. And so, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, it's been practiced all over the Muslim world, you know, for the last 1400 years. It's when reciters, specially trained vocalists, will sing verses or suryas from the Quran, often in a mosque and then now on all sorts of different channels. And the main style for Quranic recitation is called mujawad, and it's kind of amazing. And so the core of the style, it's saying you're reciting holy words, but you're doing it using all of these musical tools. You're using different scales, you're using timing, emotion, affect. And the whole point is to make the meaning of that Quran really hit the audience in the room with you right there and in that moment. And so because of it, there have been created all these rules. And it's kind of stunning. So the mujawad style, it only exists for an audience, which is to say, when you rehearse it on your own in private, you can't recite the Quran. You have to recite some secular text, like a pop song, anything, you know, epic poem. You can't use the Quran. But when you perform it before an audience, you, of course, must recite the Quran. But all the things you're doing with your voice, all the different musical melodies and notes you're hitting, they must always be improvised. And it's been going on this way for hundreds and hundreds of years. So it's this really incredible tradition where you have this emphasis on, you know, the idea is that the Quran text is holy, so that does not change. But everything else must change. And so you have these reciters who exist in this really kind of charged aesthetic tension between the fixed words of the text and this command, literally a religious command, to be free in how you vocalize. And I'm going to play you a clip. This is one of the most influential and sort of famous Quranic reciters, Sheikh Mustafa Ismail, in Cairo in the 1950s. And this is a YouTube, I'll talk about it a bit afterwards, but you'll hear him singing the same section of the Quran in three very different ways. Just to give you an example of what this sounds like. So those were recorded in a mosque And you hear the crowd sort of going wild and yelling their appreciation in certain moments. And in this tradition of Mujawad Quranic recitation, there's this belief that like every reciter will learn from great listeners. And so the idea is that there'll be certain key listeners in the audience who, when the person reciting does something particularly ingenious or evocative, they'll shout and cheer them on. And that sort of feedback loop between audience and reciter in service of this holy text makes the whole situation stronger and more powerful. But the skilled listeners are very much a part of what makes someone like Sheikh Mustafa Ismail great. And in a sense, that's something that the culture of DJed music and the culture of Quranic recitation have very much in common. There's this sense that all the meaning being created in sound, all of that power, it doesn't come from a single individual, writing notes or making the composition. It's a very complex and ever-changing relationship between performer, between audience, and between the text. You know, in this case, of course, it's a holy text. The text does not change. It's written. They've been performing those exact same words for endless years. In the case with DJ culture, it's the fixed texts of the vinyl record, you know, the fixed texts of the bits in a CD that are being shifted around and must be brought to life with each performance. But I wanted to play this YouTube clip because this, to me, brings home a key point in thinking about how copyright attenuates musical travel, which is to say, this, you know, Ismail, he got his start singing in mosques. And because he quickly became famous, he then was doing national radio broadcasts. And he never liked singing on the radio. For him, it was alienating and strange, precisely because he didn't have those skilled listeners there bringing him on. But what with the radio, he became even more popular. And so this whole culture of people who would do home tapings of his recitations emerged. And so even nowadays in Cairo, there's a scene of collectors, these mostly guys, unsurprisingly, who will have thousands of hours of this one particular man singing. And then as that culture sort of hit the internet, hit the YouTube years in 2005, those various collectors started upping bits of their Sheikh Mustafa Ismail recordings. And then people went through and started making supercuts, like the one we just saw, where they would go through, find every time Ismail recites a specific verse from the Quran, and splice together each of his versions singing it. So you can find clips up to an hour long where it's him just going through the same words over and over again, but ever changing. And so that to me brings home what all these different media shifts required to sustain a sound, sustain a musical practice, sustain a spiritual practice across time. You know, it's not some sort of techno solution that's something you can put in a code, you sign a contract and it's done, boom, no. It's saying that, wow, in order for this man's voice to still be circulating 50 years later, it's a very almost Baroque system. You know, it began in the mosque, it went to the state-owned radio platforms, then went out to the home tapers, and then ended up in the hands of the sort of messy internet creation. And that is how people like me can now find the works of Sheikh Mustafa Ismail. And so I'm so dismayed when I think of my path as a DJ nowadays, and how, as I said before, my recorded works as DJ Rupture are slowly exiting the historical record, because we're in this moment where the possible container is quite small. And so even though I've personally done so many works across vinyl, cassette, CD, MP3, those sources are becoming fewer and fewer and more difficult to access. So I think with that, I'm gonna sit down and let the next speaker sort of continue this flow of conversation.